and whatever it takes to maximize profits. A second chain reaction that undermined the common good was set off in the 1980s as corporate raiders mounted hostile takeovers of corporations financed by risky bonds. The raiders made fortunes. Wall Street became the most powerful force in the economy, and CEOs began to devote themselves entirely and obsessively to maximizing the short-term value of shares of stock. The new rule was, do whatever it takes to make huge profits. Before then, it was assumed that large corporations had responsibilities to all their stakeholders, not just their shareholders, but also their workers, the towns and cities where their headquarters and facilities were located, and the nation. The job of management, proclaimed Frank Abrams, chairman of Standard Oil of New Jersey, in a 1951 address, is to maintain an equitable and working balance among the claims of the various directly affected interest groups, stockholders, employees, customers, and the public at large. In November 1956, Time magazine noted that business leaders were willing to judge their actions not only from the standpoint of profit and loss, but of profit and loss to the community. CEOs had become corporate statesmen, responsible for the common good of the nation. General Electric, the magazine said, sought to serve the balanced best interests of all its stakeholders. As paper executive J.D. Zellerbach told Time, Americans regard business management as a stewardship, and they expect it to operate the economy as a public trust for the benefit of all the people. These sentiments may seem quaint today, but they laid the basis for rapid economic growth, and, with strong unions, an equally rapid expansion of the middle class. Starting in the 1980s, though, as a result of the corporate takeovers mounted by raiders such as Michael Milken, who is credited with inventing the use of high-risk junk bonds for such raids, as well as Ivan Boesky and Carl Icahn, a wholly different understanding about the purpose of the corporation emerged. The raiders targeted companies that could deliver higher returns to their shareholders if they abandoned their other stakeholders, fighting unions, cutting the pay of workers or firing them, automating as many jobs as possible, and abandoning their original communities by shuttering factories and moving jobs to a state with lower labor costs or moving them abroad. The raiders pushed shareholders to vote out directors who wouldn't make these sorts of changes and vote in directors who would, or else sell their shares to the raiders who do the dirty work. During the whole of the 1970s, there were only 13 hostile takeovers of big companies valued at $1 billion or more. During the 1980s, there were 150. Between 1979 and 1989, financial entrepreneurs mounted more than 2,000 leveraged buyouts, in which they bought out shareholders with borrowed money, each buyout exceeding $250 million. As a result, CEOs across America, facing the possibility of being replaced by a CEO who would maximize shareholder value, began to view their responsibilities differently. Few events change minds more profoundly than the imminent possibility of being sacked. As a result, the corporate statesmen of previous decades became the corporate butchers of the 1980s and 1990s. Whose nearly exclusive focus was, in the meat axe parlance that suddenly became fashionable, to cut out the fat, cut to the bone, and make their companies lean and mean. Given what was to follow, it's enough to make one a vegan. Between 1981, when Jack Welch took the helm at GE, and 2001, when he retired, the firm's stock value catapulted from $14 billion to $400 billion. Welch accomplished this largely by slashing American jobs. Before he became CEO, most GE employees had spent their entire careers with the company, typically at one of its facilities in upstate New York. But between 1981 and 1985, a quarter of them, 100,000 in all, lost their jobs, earning Welsh the moniker Neutron Jack and the growing admiration of the business community. Welsh encouraged his senior managers to replace 10% of their subordinates every year in order to keep GE competitive. As GE opened facilities abroad, staffed by foreign workers costing a small fraction of what GE had paid its American employees, the corporation all but abandoned upstate New York. Between the mid-1980s and the late 1990s, GE slashed its American workforce by half to about 160,000, while nearly doubling its foreign workforce to 130,000. Over the years, corporate raiders have morphed into more respectable private equity managers and activist investors, and hostile takeovers have become rare. That's only because corporate norms have utterly changed. It's now assumed that corporations exist only to maximize shareholder returns. CEOs have become so obsessed by shareholder value that Roberto Goizueta, CEO of Coca-Cola, proclaimed in 1988, "I wrestle with how to build shareholder value from the time I get up in the morning to the time I go to bed. I even think about it when I'm shaving." Goizueta's obsession was quite different from the views of his predecessors, such as Coca-Cola's president, William Robinson, who in 1959 told an audience at Fordham Law School that executives should not put stockholders first. They should balance the interests of the stockholder, the community, the customer, and the employee. Corporations have used their profits to give shareholders dividends and buy back their shares of stock, thereby reducing the number of shares outstanding and giving stock prices short-term boosts. All of this has meant more money for the top executives of big companies, whose pay began to be linked to share prices. CEO pay soared from an average of 20 times that of the typical worker in the 1960s to almost 300 times by 2017. Are we better off? Some argue shareholder capitalism has proven to be more efficient than stakeholder capitalism. It has moved economic resources to where they're most productive and thereby enabled the economy to grow faster. By this view, stakeholder capitalism locked up resources in unproductive ways. CEOs were too complacent. Corporations were too fat, employing workers they didn't need and paying them too much, and they were too tied to their communities. It's a tempting argument, but in hindsight, a fallacious one. Any change that allows some people to become better off without causing others to be worse off is technically a more efficient use of resources. But when all or most of these efficiency gains go to a few people at the top, as has been the case since the 1980s, the common good is not necessarily improved. Just look at the flat or declining wages of most Americans, their growing economic insecurity, and the abandoned communities now littering the nation. Then look at the record corporate profits, soaring CEO pay, and jaw-dropping compensation on Wall Street. All Americans are stakeholders in the American economy, and most stakeholders have not done well. As a practical matter, shareholders are not the only parties who invest in corporations and bear some of the risk that the value of their investments might drop. Workers who have been with a firm for years often develop skills and knowledge unique to it. Others may have moved their families to take a job with a firm, buying homes in the community. The community itself may have invested in roads and other infrastructure to accommodate the corporation. When a firm abandons those workers and those communities, these stakeholders lose the value of their investments. Why should no account be taken of their stakes? Executives claim they have a fiduciary obligation to maximize investors' returns. The argument is tautological. It assumes that investors are the only people worthy of consideration. What about the common good? Jared Kushner's real estate company uses arrest warrants to collect debts owed by low-income tenants, often tacking on thousands of dollars in legal fees because of its fiduciary obligation to investors, the largest of which are Jared Kushner and his family. After the company sued one of its tenants for moving out of her apartment without giving the company 2 months' notice, despite her having done so, the company won an almost $5,000 judgment against her and then garnished her wages as a home health worker and her bank account. When asked to justify such tactics, the Kushner company's chief financial officer told the New York Times that the company had a fiduciary obligation to collect as much revenue as possible. One means of making sure tenants paid their rent on time and did not break their leases early was to instill in them a sense of fear about violating a lease. The goal of maximizing profits has leached into sectors of the economy that had once been based on the common good, such as healthcare. A century ago, hospitals and health insurers had palpable public responsibilities. The original purpose of health insurance plans, devised in the 1920s at the Baylor University Medical Center in Dallas, was not to generate profits. It was to cover as many people as possible. The nonprofits, Blue Cross and Blue Shield, accepted everyone who wanted to become a member, and all members paid the same rate regardless of age or health. By the 1960s, Blue Cross was providing hospital coverage to more than 50 million Americans. In the 1970s and 1980s, though, some entrepreneurs saw ways to make big money by exploiting this common good. They founded for-profit insurance companies like Aetna and Cigna that, unhampered by the Blues' charitable mission, accepted only younger and healthier patients. This reduced their costs, enabling them to charge lower premiums than the Blues while still pocketing big profits. The Blues couldn't possibly compete, so in 1994, Blue Cross and Blue Shield succumbed and became for-profits, marking the end of non-profit health insurance, turning the American healthcare system into one that eagerly insured healthy people while trying to avoid sick people or charging people with chronic health problems a fortune for coverage. Big financial houses, meanwhile, went from small privately held investment banks to giant corporations whose shares were traded on stock exchanges. This also had unfortunate consequences. When investment bankers made all the profits and also suffered all the losses from their bets, they tended to be cautious. In order to understand the risks they were taking on, partners kept their banks small and their transactions relatively simple. But by 2000, because of deregulation, Wall Street had morphed into mega banks with employees numbering in the hundreds of thousands and spanning the globe. There were no longer any constraints on risky bets. Shareholders bore the costs, while those who made the bets got many of the upside gains in the form of giant bonuses. Bankers had every incentive to grab the cheapest funding possible to make the riskiest possible bets. And that led to the crash of 2008. When the only purpose of business is to make as much money as possible in the shortest time frame, regardless of how it's done, the common good is easily sacrificed. In pursuit of high profits, whatever it takes, CEOs and the corporations they run have ignored or circumvented the intent of laws to protect workers, communities, the environment, and consumers. They abandoned the principle of equal economic opportunity that underlay their obligations to all stakeholders, and have too often put themselves first. Despite his avowed goal to rebuild customer confidence in Wells Fargo, John Stumpf didn't care about his customers. He apparently cared only about himself. Although Martin Shkreli said he was motivated by investors who expect me to maximize profits to 100% of the profit curve, it turned out his real motive was Martin Shkreli. 3. Lewis Powell's memo, Tony Coelho's bargain, Wall Street's bailout, and whatever it takes to rig the economy. The third chain reaction eroding the common good came as a consequence of the first two. Whatever it takes, politics removed all constraints on gaining and keeping political power. Whatever it takes to make big money eliminated all checks on unbridled greed. Put them together, and what do we get? We got money pouring into politics in order to change the rules of the game in favor of big corporations and the wealthy so they could rake in even more. The start of this can be traced to 1971, when future Supreme Court Justice Lewis Powell argued in a memo he wrote at the request of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that the American economic system is under broad attack from consumer, labor, and environmental groups. In reality, these groups were doing nothing more than enforcing the implicit social contract I've referred to, ensuring that corporations were responsible to all their stakeholders. But Powell and the chamber saw it differently. Powell urged businesses to mobilize for political combat. Businesses must learn the lesson that political power is necessary, that such power must be assiduously cultivated, and that when necessary, it must be used aggressively and with determination, without embarrassment and without the reluctance which has been so characteristic of American business. Powell stressed that the critical ingredients for success were organization and funding. Strength lies in the scale of financing available only through joint effort, and in the political power available only through united action and national organizations. Powell's memo unleashed corporate money into politics, growing into the largest force in Washington and most state capitals. Once a few large corporations ramped up their lobbying and campaign contributions, competitors felt they had to do the same or lose out. The number of corporations with public affairs offices in Washington ballooned from 100 in 1968 to over 500 a decade later. In 1971, only 175 firms had registered lobbyists in the nation's capital. By 1982, nearly 2,500 had them. The number of corporate political action committees mushroomed from under 300 in 1976 to over 1,200 by 1980. Smaller businesses joined together in trade associations and business groups to do their bidding. Between 1974 and 1980, the Chamber of Commerce doubled its membership. By the 1990s, when I was Secretary of Labor, corporations employed some 61,000 people to lobby for them, including registered lobbyists and lawyers. That came to more than 100 for each member of Congress. Corporate money has also supported platoons of lawyers who represent corporations and the very rich in regulatory and court proceedings, often outgunning the Justice Department and state attorneys general. Corporations have also funded think tanks and public relations firms. Most important, corporations began inundating politicians with money for their campaigns. Between the late 1970s and the late 1980s, corporate political action committees increased their expenditures on congressional races nearly fivefold. Labor union PAC spending rose only about half as fast. By the 2016 campaign cycle, corporations and Wall Street contributed $34 for every $1 donated by labor unions and all public interest organizations combined. Wealthy individuals also accounted for a growing share. In 1980, the richest 0.01% of Americans provided 10% of contributions to federal elections. By 2012, they provided 40%. The Supreme Court has made all this worse through a series of decisions holding that money is speech under the First Amendment and corporations are people. Both political parties have transformed themselves from mainly state and local organizations that channeled the views of members upward into giant top-down fundraising machines. In the 1980s, the Democratic Party began drinking at the same trough as the GOP. "Business has to deal with us whether they like it or not, because we're the majority," crowed Democratic Representative Tony Coelho, who, as head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, commenced a shakedown of corporate America. Coelho's Democrats soon achieved a rough parity with Republicans in contributions from corporate and Wall Street campaign coffers. It proved a Faustian bargain. Once hooked on corporate money, Democrats couldn't unhook themselves. The Democrats' dependence on big corporations became evident when months before the party's trouncing in the 1994 midterms, many congressional Democrats voted against Bill Clinton's health care plan because their corporate sponsors opposed it. Business executives haven't cared which party they contribute to, as long as the money gets results. During the 2016 Republican primaries, Donald Trump, who was then getting attacked by his GOP rivals for having once donated money to Hillary Clinton, explained that, "As a businessman and a very substantial donor to very important people, when you give, they do whatever the hell you want them to. As a businessman, I need that." Apparently, he got what he needed after Trump's charitable foundation made a $25,000 contribution to a campaign organization linked to Florida's attorney general. She decided not to open a fraud investigation of Trump University that her office had been considering. Businesses have also dangled before public officials the lure of well-paying jobs after government. In the 1970s, only about 3% of retiring members of Congress went on to become Washington lobbyists. By 2016, fully half of all retiring senators and 42% of retiring representatives had turned to lobbying, regardless of party affiliation. This wasn't because more recent retirees have had fewer qualms than their predecessors about making money off their contacts in government. It was because the financial rewards from corporate lobbying had ballooned. The revolving door rotates the other way, too. If a lobbyist can land a plum job in an administration, he or she becomes even more valuable on leaving. In his first 6 months as president, Trump handed control of every major regulatory agency to lobbyists from the industries they would oversee. The quid is tightly linked to the quo. After Wall Street became a gusher of campaign funds starting in the 1980s, the street got Congress to repeal Depression-era regulations that for half a century had prevented another great crash. Restrictions on interstate banking, on intermingling investment and commercial banking, and on banks becoming publicly held corporations. This freed the street to once again gamble with other people's money, and led in 2008 to a financial crisis similar to the one that occurred in 1929. A giant taxpayer-funded bailout kept the big banks from going under and avoided another Great Depression, but homeowners and workers caught in the downdraft received no such help. Millions lost their jobs, homes, and savings. Millions more felt vulnerable. Not surprisingly, the day-to-day decisions emanating from Congress and the White House no longer reflect the views of average Americans. After examining 1,799 policy issues in detail, two eminent researchers, Princeton professor Martin Gillens and professor Benjamin Page of Northwestern University, concluded that, quote, the preferences of the average American appear to have only a minuscule, near zero, statistically non-significant impact upon public policy, end quote. All of this has enhanced the economic gains flowing to big firms and the wealthy, while reducing the share going to the majority of Americans. It's been a vast redistribution, essentially taking money out of the paychecks of the middle class and poor and channeling it upward. Intellectual property rights, patents, trademarks, and copyrights have been enlarged and extended, allowing pharmaceuticals, high-tech, biotechnology, and many entertainment companies to preserve their monopolies longer. This has meant higher prices for average consumers, including the highest pharmaceutical costs of any advanced nation. At the same time, antitrust laws have been relaxed, resulting in large profits for firms like Monsanto, which sets the prices for most of the nation's seed corn. For a handful of high-tech companies with market power over network portals and platforms, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, and Google, cable companies with little or no broadband competition, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and the largest Wall Street banks, among others. As with the broadening of intellectual property rights, the relaxing of antitrust laws has raised prices and reduced services for average Americans. We have the most expensive and slowest broadband of any industrialized nation, for example. In 2016, The Economist magazine reported that two-thirds of all corporate sectors have become more concentrated since the 1990s, making corporations far more profitable than at any time since the 1920s. Contract laws have been altered so that consumers and employees can't take their grievances to court. They have to use arbitrators selected by big corporations. A few states have enacted non-compete laws, making it impossible for employees to leave their jobs for new ones unless they can show that the move would not adversely affect their current employer, leaving workers and their wages at the mercy of their bosses. Securities laws have been relaxed to allow insider trading of confidential information and to let CEOs use stock buybacks to boost share prices when they cash in their own stock options. Tax laws have been altered to create loopholes for the partners of hedge funds and private equity funds, special favors for the oil and gas industry, lower marginal income tax rates on the highest incomes, and reduced estate taxes on great wealth. Bankruptcy laws have been loosened for large corporations, notably airlines and automobile manufacturers, allowing them to rip up labor contracts, threaten closures unless they receive wage concessions, and leave workers and communities stranded. Notably, bankruptcy has not been extended to homeowners who owe more on their homes than their homes are worth, or to graduates overburdened with student debt. Meanwhile, as I've noted, the largest banks and auto manufacturers were bailed out in the downturn of 2008-2009. The result has been to shift the risks of economic failure onto the backs of average working people and taxpayers. Finally, taxes have been reduced on corporations and the wealthy, even as corporate profits and the incomes of the rich have soared. In all these ways, and more, the market has been altered to redistribute money from the middle class and poor to the wealthy. It is a vicious cycle. As large corporations and the wealthy accumulate more of the nation's assets, they gain more power to rig the market to their advantage. Chapter 6. The Decline of the Good in Common. To repeat, three exploitations of trust set off chain reactions that have undermined the common good. Whatever it takes to win politics disregarded what had been the unwritten rules of good government based on equal political rights, enabling the most powerful players to extract all political gains. Whatever it takes to maximize profits rejected what had been the unwritten rules of corporate responsibility based on obligations to all stakeholders, allowing CEOs, Wall Street, and investors to extract all financial gains. Whatever it takes to rig the economy dismissed what had been the unwritten rule that the free market should work for everyone, permitting the most powerful economic actors to extract almost all economic gains. As a result, the key political and economic institutions of our society, political parties, corporations, and the free market, have abandoned their commitment to the common good. The consequence has been a catastrophe for most Americans. By 2016, the typical American household had a net worth 14% lower than the typical household in 1984, while the richest 0.1% owned almost as much wealth as the bottom 90% put together. Income has become almost as unequal as wealth. Between 1972 and 2016, the pay of the typical American worker dropped 2%, adjusted for inflation, although the American economy nearly doubled in size. Most of the income gains went to the top. In 2016, the annual Wall Street bonus pool alone was larger than the annual year-round earnings of all 3.3 million Americans working full-time at the federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. The middle class is shrinking. Whereas 90% of American adults born in the early 1940s were earning more than their parents by the time they reached their prime earning years, this proportion has steadily declined. Only half of adults born in the mid-1980s are earning more than their parents by their prime earning years. Most Americans are working longer hours than they had worked decades before and taking fewer sick days or vacations. And they are falling behind the economic security enjoyed by their parents. Nearly one out of every five is in a part-time job. Two-thirds are living paycheck to paycheck. Along with pay, employment benefits have been shriveling. The gap in life expectancy between the nation's most affluent and everyone else is widening as well. Increasing numbers of working Americans have been succumbing to opioids. Death rates have been rising for Americans with high school degrees or less due to suicides, chronic liver cirrhosis, and poisonings, including drug overdoses. Discrimination based on race, gender, and ethnicity has magnified these economic differences, and the economic stresses have fueled further bigotry. Many Americans who for decades have been on a downward economic escalator have become easy prey for demagogues peddling the politics of hate. While in the 1950s and 1960s, the nation began struggling to overcome racial discrimination, progress has slowed and in many respects reversed. By 2017, a higher share of America's population was in jail or prison than in almost any other country on the planet, and the inmates were disproportionately black and Latino. The standard explanation for why America has become so economically lopsided is that most Americans are no longer worth as much as they were before digital technologies and globalization, and therefore must now settle for lower wages and less security. If they want better jobs, they need more education and better skills. This account doesn't explain why other advanced economies facing similar forces haven't succumbed to them nearly as dramatically as has the United States, or why America's U-turn from broadly shared prosperity to stagnant wages for most and great riches for a few occurred so quickly in the late 1970s and 1980s. It doesn't clarify why the pay of top executives of big companies rose so dramatically since then, or why the denizens of Wall Street are now paid tens or hundreds of millions annually. Nor can it account for the decline in wages of recent college graduates, although young people with college degrees have continued to outpace people without them. The real average hourly wages of young college graduates have dropped since 2000. A college education has become a prerequisite for joining the middle class, but it is no longer a sure means for gaining ground once admitted to it. To attribute all this to the impersonal workings of the free market is to be blind to the disproportionate political power of America's economic elites over the rules of the game, and their failure to use that power to deliver rising or even stable incomes and jobs to most of the rest of the nation. It's to ignore the increasing willingness of moneyed interests to rig the system for their own benefit, and their dwindling concern for the common good. As they gained more wealth and power, they could have made a different choice. They could have used their political and economic clout to get better schools for all, comprehensive job retraining, wage insurance, better public transportation, and expanded unemployment insurance. They could have pushed for universal health insurance. They could have paid for all of this by accepting, even lobbying for, higher taxes on themselves. They could have strengthened rather than fought off unions, and pushed for laws giving workers more rather than less voice. They could have demanded limits on campaign spending. They did the reverse. They spent more and more of their ever-expanding wealth to alter the rules of the game to their own advantage. We're now living with the consequences. The ethos of whatever it takes to win has taken a profound toll. Much of the public no longer believes that the major institutions of America are working for the many. They're vessels for the few. In 1963, over 60% of Americans trusted government to do the right thing all or most of the time. Nowadays, only 16% do. In 1964, more than 60% thought government was run for the benefit of all the people, while just 29% said government was pretty much run by a few big interests looking out for themselves. Nowadays, the numbers are almost reversed, with 76% believing government is run by a few big interests, and just 19% saying government is run for the benefit of all. There has been a similar decline in trust for corporations. In the early 1960s, most Americans said they had a great deal of confidence in the nation's major companies, banks, and financial institutions. Now, just 1 in 10 has a great deal of confidence in them. Public trust has also plummeted for nonprofits, universities, charities, and religious institutions. Trust in the media has dropped as well, even before Donald Trump's disparagement, as has that for the scientific community. The decline in trust has not been confined to the United States. A similar erosion has occurred in other advanced nations, and for a similar reason. The political and economic systems that fostered widespread prosperity and democracy in the 3 decades after World War II have ceased to work for most people. They became the vehicles for elites to entrench their wealth and power. When the game is widely seen as rigged in favor of those at the top, others view cheating as acceptable or fear they'll become chumps if they don't cheat. The system becomes rife with smaller bamboozles and con jobs, frauds and swindles, Employees pilfer from employers. Middle managers skim off some of the profits and accept small bribes and kickbacks from contractors. Professional ethics wither among lawyers, doctors, accountants, even professional athletes who feel freer to cheat. Politicians bestow favors on campaign donors. As a result, rules are tightened. Time-consuming screening and security checks are imposed. Additional reviews are instituted. Red tape multiplies with the profusion of finagles it seeks to contain. Contracts become longer and more convoluted. There's less willingness to put in extra effort or go the extra mile, to do what is needed but not required, to report unexpected problems or devise new solutions, to blow the whistle on illegality. The overall economy may show some growth because of all this additional spending on security personnel, screeners, accountants, auditors, lawyers, law enforcers, and monitoring equipment. But these defensive expenditures do not enhance anyone's quality of life. Another consequence is that society shifts from a system of mutual obligations to a system of private deals. Rather than being founded in the common good, political and social relationships increasingly are viewed as contracts. People ask less about their obligations in various situations, more about what's in it for them. When it's all about making deals, one gets ahead by getting ahead of others. Duty is replaced by self-aggrandizement and self-promotion. Calls for sacrifice or self-denial are replaced by personal demands for better deals. It's commonly supposed that contemporary Americans are no longer joiners, as we once were. We bowl alone, as sociologist Robert Putnam has put it. Yet this fails to account for a monumental shift in whom we join and for what. We still join together, but now we join for services too expensive to purchase alone. Childcare, the schools our children attend, recreational facilities, and security. Rather than come together for the common good, we come together to get the best possible deal. We're clustering by income, attracting members who can contribute the most while excluding those who are more costly. Whether called private or public, the underlying mechanism is the same. Membership dues pay for services in exclusive private residential communities, while local property taxes pay for them in exclusive public townships, like Vail or Greenwich. But in neither case is the endeavor common. It's for people with the same high incomes. Public schools in exclusive communities are public in name only, because tuition payments are disguised within high home prices, local property taxes, and parental donations. Parents are intent on policing the boundaries, lest a child whose parents haven't paid the same price reap the same advantages as their own child. Hell hath no fury like an upscale parent who thinks another child is getting an unfair advantage by sneaking in under the fence. In November 2016, school officials in Orinda, California, determined that a 7-year-old named Vivian, whose single mother worked as a live-in nanny for a family in Orinda, did not reside in the district and should not be allowed to attend the elementary school she was already attending there. Vivian is Latina and poor, and Orinda is white and wealthy. Orinda schools are among the best in California. Public schools that glean extra revenues from a local parcel tax that required a 2/3 vote to pass, and parental contributions to the Educational Foundation of Orinda, which suggests donations of $600 per child. Harold Freeman, Orinda's district attorney, said the district had to preserve the resources of the district for all the students, that is, all of Orinda's students, which is why the district spends some of its dollars to root out children like Vivian. After Vivian's story exploded in the media, Orinda's school district backed down and informed her mother that Vivian would not be kicked out. Private homeowners' associations have spearheaded citizens' movements against state and local taxes because their members see no reason why they should pay to support families outside the gates when members get everything they need inside through their dues. As a result, poorer children are increasingly bunched together with other poorer children within schools that have relatively few resources to begin with. The economic secession of upper middle class and wealthy families is also leading America back toward racially segregated neighborhoods and classrooms. The probability that a black student will have white classmates has dropped to what it was before 1954, when the Supreme Court in Brown versus Board of Education declared separate schools inherently unequal. The same mechanism explains the upsurge of private parents' foundations in the wake of court decisions requiring richer school districts to subsidize poorer ones. Rather than pay the extra taxes, upscale parents have quietly shifted their support to these charities so they can keep more of their money in the schools their kids attend. Residents of Malibu, California, more solidly affluent than the residents of neighboring Santa Monica, which shares the same school district, want to keep their donations in Malibu schools. Craig Foster, a Malibu resident and former managing director at Morgan Stanley and Credit Suisse, told the New York Times that parents who donate their money deserve to benefit from the fruits of their donations. A parent should have, quote, the opportunity to put your money where your heart is, he said. Quote, it has to be an emotional appeal, and it has to be for the benefit of the donor, end quote. Benefit of the donor? What happened to the common good? The extreme economic rewards available to those who make it, compared to the economic perils facing those who don't, have caused many parents to become hyper-competitive. They worry that if they don't get their children into good preschools that lead to good primary and secondary schools, and then into good colleges, their offspring will fall backward economically, or alternatively, lose their chance to become well-off. So they're less generous when it comes to sending their tax dollars and donations to schools and children from lower economic classes. As these parents become increasingly efficient at passing their economic status on to their children, they create an ever more rigid class division in America. Rather than see this for what it is, economic winners seceding from the common good, some commentators condemn the losers for lacking initiative. In his 2012 book, Coming Apart, sociologist Charles Murray, the darling of conservative intellectuals, attributed the demise of America's white working class to what Murray described as their loss of traditional values of diligence and hard work. He argued they brought their problems on themselves by becoming addicted to drugs, failing to marry, giving birth out of wedlock, dropping out of high school, and remaining jobless for long periods of time. Government has aided and abetted their decline, he argued, by providing help that encourages these social pathologies. Murray and others of his stripe seem not to have noticed that, as I've said, the wages of the white working class have stagnated or declined for the past 40 years. Steady jobs, once available to them, have disappeared. The economic base of their communities has deteriorated, and their share of the nation's income and wealth has dramatically shrunk. It seems far more likely that these are the underlying source of the social pathologies Murray chronicles, and that the drug addiction, out of wedlock births, lack of education, and unemployment are its symptoms rather than the other way around. This logic is inconvenient, however, because it suggests that any real solution requires reversing the widening inequities that have hit the old working class especially hard and embracing a more inclusive view of the common good. Many commentators embrace a kind of social Darwinism in which struggling whites, like poor blacks, are assumed to be unfit to survive. During the 2016 Republican presidential primaries, National Review columnist Kevin Williamson wrote that these dysfunctional downscale communities deserve to die. Economically, they're negative assets. Morally, they are indefensible. Forget all your cheap theatrical Bruce Springsteen crap. Forget your sanctimony about struggling Rust Belt factory towns. The white American underclass is enthralled to a vicious, selfish culture whose main products are misery and used heroin needles. Donald Trump's speeches make them feel good. So does OxyContin. In a similar vein, during the congressional fight over repealing the Affordable Care Act in the spring of 2017, Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks argued that repeal would reduce the cost to those people who lead good lives. They're healthy. They've done the things to keep their bodies healthy, end quote. Mick Mulvaney, Trump's budget director, conceded that while people who get cancer should have some sort of safety net, he was quick to add, quote, that doesn't mean we should take care of the person who sits at home, eats poorly, and gets diabetes, end quote. America's political and economic leaders paid little heed when in the years leading up to the financial crisis of 2008, highly paid bankers pocketed huge sums while exposing most Americans to extraordinary economic risks. The people who subsequently lost their jobs, savings, and homes, though, were understandably outraged, especially when these same bankers suffered no consequences. Within a few years of the financial crisis, most of the bankers returned to pocketing vast fortunes, but most other Americans were still living with the consequences. Their anger began to engulf American politics on both sides of the aisle. In the 2016 Democratic primaries, Bernie Sanders said, "This type of rigged economy is not what America's supposed to be about." At the start of her campaign, Hillary Clinton conceded that the deck is still stacked in favor of those at the top. Candidate Donald Trump proclaimed, "The system is rigged against the citizens," and that he was the only candidate who cannot be bought, a refrain he repeated all the way to the White House. The left has focused its ire on corporations and Wall Street, the right on government. In fact, the two are inextricably related. Trump's anti-establishment authoritarian populism overlapped with Sanders' anti-establishment democratic populism in condemning elites that made off with almost all the gains. "The establishment protected itself, but not the citizens of our country. Their victories have not been your victories. Their triumphs have not been your triumphs. And while they celebrated in our nation's capital, there was little to celebrate for struggling families all across our land," said Trump in his inaugural speech. Some individuals, like Martin Shkreli and others I've mentioned, have directly abused the public's trust. Most of America's political and economic elites, in Washington's corridors of power, within the executive suites of large corporations, and on Wall Street, have been guilty of simply playing along. They've averted their eyes from the disintegration of the common good. They failed to insist on major reforms. They have denied, rationalized, and told themselves the disintegration was inevitable. Yet the arbitrariness and unfairness is widely felt. In a 2001 Gallup poll, 76% of Americans were satisfied with opportunities to get ahead by working hard, and only 22% were dissatisfied. By 2014, only 54% were satisfied, with 45% dissatisfied. According to the Pew Research Center, the percentage of Americans who felt that most people who want to get ahead could do so through hard work dropped by 14 points between 2000 and 2014. Aristotle warned that excessive inequality can bring political instability. You can see and feel the anger, even in mundane situations. As first-class sections of airplanes have become more spacious, they seem to be triggering more incidents of air rage among passengers seated in the back. Researchers Catherine DeSales of the University of Toronto and Michael Norton of Harvard Business School analyzed disruptive passenger incidents in an airline's database of millions of domestic and international airline flights. They found that flights with a first-class section were nearly four times more likely to have incidents of belligerent behavior or emotional outbursts in their economy class. Such incidents were even more likely when economy passengers had to walk through the first-class section to get to their seats than when they entered through the middle of the plane and bypassed the first-class section. This sort of anger can attach itself to any convenient scapegoat, to immigrants, foreigners, Latinos, African Americans, women, particular religious groups, opposing political parties. It's an open invitation to demagogues to sow division as a political tactic and build political power based on bigotry and resentment. As I've noted, democracies require sufficient social cohesion that citizens regard the interests and views of those with whom they disagree as being worthy of equal consideration to their own. Unfortunately, the percentage of Americans who regard the other party as a fundamental threat has been growing steadily. By 2014, before the acrimony of the 2016 presidential campaign and the divisiveness of the Trump presidency, 35% of Republicans saw the Democratic Party as a threat to the nation's well-being, and 27% of Democrats regarded Republicans the same way, according to Pew. Under these circumstances, people can become susceptible to demagogues who tell them not to believe researchers, scientists, journalists, and other fact-finders who don't support the demagogue's views. As a result, truth itself is imperiled as a common good. Republican Senator Jeff Flake wrote of the 2016 electorate, "Who could blame the people who felt abandoned and ignored by the major parties for reaching in despair for a candidate who offered oversimplified answers to infinitely complex questions and managed to entertain them in the process? With hindsight, it is clear that we all but ensured the rise of Donald Trump." Can we restore the common good? Can the system be made to work for the good of all? Part 3. Can the common good be restored? Chapter 7. Leadership as trusteeship. What choice do we have other than to try to restore a commitment to the common good? Without it, we're no longer a functioning society. Yet given the serious depletion of the pool of trust on which our society depends, reversing the whatever-it-takes forces that have eroded the common good during the past half-century poses a daunting challenge. They can't be reversed through better laws or wiser policies, because in order to make such laws and policies, there must first be a strong consensus that they're necessary, as well as the political power to get them enacted and to enforce them in ways they cannot be circumvented. No such consensus exists, and no such power is readily available. So we have to go deeper, back to the attitudes and understandings that shape public morality, in the hopes of possibly strengthening them. One place to begin is with leadership. I'm talking about people vested with formal authority to run major businesses, government, universities, charities, unions, and faith-based institutions. All of them carry around in their heads a definition of what it means to be successful. These days, that definition is usually focused on accumulating for themselves and their organizations more power or wealth, whatever it takes. But this definition is profoundly inadequate. Leaders must see that part of their responsibility is to rebuild public trust in the institutions they oversee. Leadership must entail trusteeship. Leaders are stewards of the unwritten rules we once took for granted that constituted the common good. As I've shown, CEOs half a century ago understood that corporations were not just for shareholders, but also for employees, communities, customers, and the public as a whole. Banks existed not to make wild bets with other people's money, but to protect depositors' and investors' savings and to prudently lend them. Health insurers existed to provide coverage to everyone who needed it,